This episode of The Edge is brought to you by Audible.com, offering more than 180,000 titles for smartphone, tablet, and desktop. To get a free audiobook of your choice and help Trek.fm at the same time, visit audibletrial.com/trekfm. And also by Enterprise in Space, an international program of the nonprofit National Space Society. Find out how you can help science and education and become a virtual crew member aboard the NSS Enterprise Orbiter by visiting enterpriseinspace.org. And if you want to join the conversation and share your thoughts on this episode, join the Babel Conference, our listeners group on Facebook. Just type B-A-B-E-L into the Facebook search field. We look forward to seeing you there.
Hey, this is Jeff Russo. I'm the composer from Star Trek Discovery, and you're listening to Trek FM.
What have you done out there on the edge of Federation space?
Welcome, listeners, to another episode of The Edge, Trek FM's dedicated podcast to Star Trek Discovery. I am your co-host, Nick Collinson. Joining me today is Brandy Jackler and Liam Smart. How are you both today?
No! I was waiting for Liam to go, you know, and talk first. And
same.
So we both were just, oh, that was hilarious.
Oh, I'm good, thanks.
I couldn't plan that any better. It was not planned, but yeah. And I'm well.
I'm very well.
We're all well.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
you well,
I'm
Brandy?
Well.
We're all well. Now we're talking
yeah,
over the top
fine.
Of each other.
Nick, are you well? How are you, Nick?
I am pretty well. Tired, but well.
I know that feeling. Yeah.
How's A Bug's Life 3 going, Nick?
Oh, it's going. It will hopefully be gone soon.
When's it due out in cinemas?
It is due for a filmmaking metaphor that I can't think of right now on the 11th of July.
It's going to be streaming on Disney Plus only.
So, first things first today, obviously, I think we should talk about the big news, even though I feel like every Star Trek podcast and talking personality under the sun has probably mentioned this already, but yes, we know it. It's been confirmed. It's official. We are getting a Captain Pike, Spock, and Number One on the Enterprise show, Star Trek Strange New Worlds.
Brandy, how does that make you feel?
It makes me feel all warm and tingly inside and very emotional. So emotional. I'm super excited. Really super excited.
Yeah, it'll be awesome.
It's going to be so good. I'm so excited for it, too.
And to pick up three characters that are from a 1960s pilot that never got aired.
1964.
To be specific, yes. And to pick up on some characters that people saw from season two of Discovery that people are continually saying that aren't us, that isn't necessarily their favourite Trek. It's just pretty. It's pretty nice to see something from our show be carried on forward into a spin-off.
Yeah. Agree.
And I like someone made this, said, you know, is this the longest period between a pilot and a show being picked up ever?
I would probably say yes.
I reckon so. I think that was Dan and Bruce saying on
yes, it
Positively
was.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Which everyone should go and listen to.
Absolutely, you should. You can find it on the on all the podcatchers under Positively Trek. And you can also find it on Dan's YouTube channel, which is Kurt Ratz Productions. Mm-hmm. Go and subscribe today to get all of the latest videos and podcasts.
For only $9.99.
You can become a patron of the YouTube channel, you know, if you wanted to. So we like Bruce and Dan. So
mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah. And, like, Dan's YouTube channel is honestly just one of the best Star Trek YouTube channels out there, I think.
Agree. Yes. Mm-hmm. He's just so positive, and it's so refreshing, and he's just entertaining. I adore him, and I adore Bruce, but everyone already knows that. I'm not saying anything new.
So obviously we get a little bit more action from your cardboard cutout behind you in a TV show, Brandy.
Yes, he's going to watch every episode with me.
He will. When do you think it'll be set?
I would imagine that it's going to be set after Discovery Season 2, because there's still a good 10 years between, you know, that and when Kirk takes over the Enterprise. So
yeah,
they have plenty of leeway to work with. I don't think that they would go back in time to before the events of Discovery. I just don't see why they would do that. It's not necessary. Let's know more about the stuff we don't know about, which is after. So
I would hope that they would pick up after Discovery left off, fill in a few of the like gaps and unanswered questions that we discussed a couple of podcasts ago.
Yes.
That means to me that it will probably, like, if the show is picked up for a few more seasons, it will probably end with Pike's accident.
Oh, that'll be so heartbreaking.
Would be, a bit of a downer ending.
Oh.
But I don't know. Like, they are going to have him dealing with knowing that that's his fate, at least.
Oh, yes. And that's great. You know, I mean, it's not great that that's his fate, but it's great. Now he knows that, and it's in the back of his mind, and it influences how he does everything, really. Interesting. There's so much they can do there that I am so very looking forward to.
Anyway, new season announcements, and just how much we love our friends Dan and Bruce, not all we are here to talk about today on The Edge. So today we've decided we are going to talk about the behind-the-scenes special features from the Season 1 Blu-ray set, because there is over 3 hours worth of special features stuff. And, I mean, I personally love all that kind of stuff. It's actually been quite a while since I've owned, you know, a DVD or a Blu-ray of something, because we watch so much stuff online these days. But yeah, I used to just like sit and just watch through all of those like behind the scenes documentaries about everything. So this was really fun.
I adore behind the scenes stuff. I just gobble it up, which is why I tend to get Blu-rays of the things that I really, really love, which was a no-brainer for Discovery. And in fact, I got the Steelbooks for those, for both season one and season two, that apparently were exclusively at Best Buy. So at least, you know, I had a way to get them.
The what?
Steelbook.
What's a steelbook?
It's a steel case.
Oh, okay.
I'll show it to you.
Yeah, the big special edition steel, like, flip you open.
Oh, so is that what they're called? I've got one of those for, like, an X-Men trilogy or something.
See this pretty front there, and then there's the pretty back there. The audience does not care about any of this. One of my discs was not placed properly.
Use your imagination, listeners.
So, let me get that in there. So, but yeah, all of the discs in here, it's got a little flip over thing. It's all in this nice, tidy, hardy case that I don't feel is going to snap in two every time I open it. I love steelbooks.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah. I adore steelbooks. I can't always afford them, but, you know, when it's something special, like in this case, Discovery, I will spring for it.
See, it's rare that I watch behind-the-scenes things of anything. I think the last time I watched a behind-the-scenes stuff on a Blu-ray or DVD was probably Star Trek Voyager, when I was re-watching it on DVDs. Maybe like 11 years ago or something like that. So, I mean, it's always a pleasant surprise for me to see these things. And the amount of work that goes into everything, it's terrifying.
Oh, my Lord.
Oh, yeah.
I know. How do they ever get anything done?
It's just like, oh, my God. I mean, obviously, we don't see any of that behind-the-scenes stuff. We know how much it goes into taking a TV show from just the shooting and the directing aspects of it. But my gosh, the time it takes for them to just do one of those little spikes on the Klingon outfits.
Ridiculous.
Ridiculous.
That's why you have a team who does just that stuff.
Mm.
You have one person designated to do this stuff, one person designated to do this stuff. So, this person is making the spikes, this person is cutting the patterns, this person is, you know, molding the leather. They each have their own job. And so, it's almost like an assembly line in a way, but without being that immediate, because this takes a lot of care and skill and time to do.
It's just crazy the amount of work that's gone into it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
And it's amazing to see.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So how long did it take us all to get through the special features?
A long time.
Yeah.
I split it
over like two or three evenings.
Yeah. I did it mine on a Sunday morning and I just decided I'm just going to power through. I've got my drink. I've got a snack and let's go. I did pause it once to go use the restroom because I'd had a lot to drink. So maybe I shouldn't have had the drink and the snack while I was doing that. But yeah, I just thought, wow, this was comprehensive.
I had mine over breakfast on Tuesday morning before I went into uni. I should have been doing my report, but I'm not doing that because everything else is far more interesting than my report. So, I've only got 2 weeks before I got to submit it. Whoops, I've written 3 pages.
Oh, my God, do you write your report?
I've written 3 pages of 20-plus that I have to do, and I don't want to do it. It's boring. It's really, really boring.
Yeah.
Anyway, the other thing that is a very first world problem, but getting up to change the Blu-rays and the different discs. It's such a first world problem, but I'm like, thank God we've got like streaming platforms now.
Yeah, that didn't bother me at all because I was watching them on my PlayStation 4, which was like 3 feet away from me.
So yeah, same, but you're still going to get off the couch. Like, oh, too hard.
No, I really just leaned forward, actually.
I have to get off the couch and walk to the other side of the room.
Yeah, I don't actually mind that.
And that was my exercise for Tuesday morning, I suppose.
We'll start first off with, the first of the special features on the first disc is called Discovering Discovery, Concepts and Casting of Star Trek Discovery. So, yeah, God, they're all blending together a little bit for me. But this was good, like, especially a lot of interviews with the creators just about the process of getting everything involved. And I did, like, there were a lot of interviews with Sonequa Martin-Green in this one about, you know, being cast as Michael Burnham. And she is just so excited to be part of this and to be, like, putting on that role. She seems just a really, like, lovely, wholesome person.
She is.
Which is really nice.
She is. I've seen her in interviews, and I just always enjoy her. She just is really enthusiastic all the time. And I loved, I believe it was Gretchen Berg talking about how they'd had so much trouble finding a Michael Burnham.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Then Sonequa walks in, and they're all just like, oh. And they couldn't, she was just like, hurry up and finish the reading. I got to call CBS right now. It's just, I loved that story.
From a commercial point of view as well, I suppose, they've just had someone walk in from one of the biggest TV franchises going in The Walking Dead, wanting to be part of their show as well.
Yeah, well, see, I didn't watch The Walking Dead, so I had no prior knowledge of Sonequa Martin-Green.
Oh, really?
Really, because I watched 2 episodes of The Walking Dead, and in those 2 episodes, I realized that this show was not made for me, and so I just stopped watching. I didn't bitch about it. I didn't get nasty about it on social media.
You're an adult?
Yes, I am an adult.
Oh.
Imagine that.
Oh.
You allowed a show to exist that you did not like?
I did.
And without saying horrible things about it?
Brandy, I think we need to take you to the doctor's. That's not normal social media etiquette.
It's not. But I've been abnormal all my life. Why change now?
Oh, honey, so am I.
Oh, yeah.
There was also little bits in there from Alex Kurtzman as well, saying that like the skirmishes with the Klingons were never alluded to. Or, sorry, they were alluded to, but never expanded upon. And one thing that he did say was that he was looking forward to spending time on the bridge and talking. That's a bit of a paraphrase, but seeing the characters of the bridge because that's what happened on TNG, etc. And we kind of know that that's not really what happened in the end with the show.
Yeah.
But, you know, this was obviously made in the very first couple of episodes during Vulcan Hello and Battle of the Binaries because we see Sonequa in her bit where she's rolling through debris on the way to the artifact.
Yes. And I love how enthusiastic she was about that. I mean, she was just so enthusiastic about everything, loving every little bit of the process.
I feel like it would be very hard not to be that enthusiastic to be in a show like Star Trek Discovery, especially to be doing like a spacewalk scene or something like that. Because even though it's all going to be green screen and stuff, you're still going to be sort of up on the wires and sort of spinning around. I don't know. I feel like that would just be something that I would find really cool, just to do all of that and then see it afterwards and be like, ah, that's me.
Yeah.
This is going to sound really stupid, but I didn't realize just the amount of green screens there would be. It's like, everything is computer. I would not work out how to act that. You're like just acting towards a green screen.
Yeah. But all of the displays, those were real.
Those are real, yeah.
Even the see-through ones, I didn't realize that.
That was cool.
Yeah, and they were saying, like, there are only a few of these, like, transparent, like, display screens in the world, and I think we got all of them for our set.
Yeah, they don't make them anymore, from what I heard.
Oh, really?
Oh, wow.
So, they better take really good care of them.
Now, do you know what was my favorite little bit about this featurette? Let's call it a featurette. That sounds dainty.
Yes.
Is Jason Isaacs, when he was sort of talking about stuff, but the words might is right came out of his mouth. And I'm like, wow, that is the way that everyone is going, that might is right. And that's exactly the kind of show that they wanted to be, to show and parallel what's happening in the real world. And that's pretty much what's going on. And you know what? Might is not right.
Well, it seems so much that that's definitely what got Jason Isaacs on board, was to be able to, like, portray that aspect of it, to, you know, for him to be his character and be from the Mirror Universe and show, you know, because the Mirror Universe, as they portrayed it, was very much a reflection of a lot of the things that we are going through now, and even were a couple of years ago when the first season came out. And, yeah, Jason Isaacs has just been so, you know, openly vocal about you know, his own sort of socio-political views and just his views in general on, you know, the world at the moment, and just how passionate he is about being on Star Trek Discovery and holding up a mirror to that part of society. It's always wonderful to see the interviews with him talking about it.
Well, isn't that what Star Trek does? Every iteration of Star Trek reflects what's going on in our society at that time, but also reflects problems that are timeless, that we are still having, that we were having in the 60s and we're still having now. So that's what Star Trek does. And anyone who thinks that Star Trek has never been about that hasn't really watched Star Trek that well.
Yeah.
All right. And then the next featurette was a fun little one on the Star Trek theme. So about finding the sound and talking with with composer Jeff Russo about composing the theme song for Star Trek Discovery. And I mean, you know, I'm a muso, so I loved this one. I love hearing about the composition process, and I actually just love the theme song itself.
I do too.
I always love hearing. Sorry.
No, that's okay. Go ahead and finish your thought.
Yeah, I was just saying, and I always love hearing from composers for TV shows and films about the process that they go through to come up with the, you know, the overall theme song, of course, but also just the interstitial music. You know, they'll be shown a scene and then have to come up with music to fit it.
I find that fascinating because I don't have the kind of brain that can hear an orchestra in my head. And that's what a composer has to be able to do. They have to be able to, you know, hear like a melody, but now create that with an orchestra and all of the things around that melody. And it's mind-blowing to me. I so respect anyone who does that because it can't be easy. It really takes an innate talent that not everyone has. And I really love Jeff Russo's work. I really, really love his work. I have the season one soundtrack. I have the season two soundtrack. I have the Picard soundtrack. I really adore his work.
I listen to the soundtrack for Discovery when I'm studying or procrastinating whenever when you kind of feel like at that time. Yeah. One thing that he says, though, is that each new show has had its own theme. Obviously, it's had its own theme song, but it's had its own theme within the show. As in, you've had, taking TOS out of it, you've got TNG, which is all like the whole jubilant theme that it's got going with going out and seeking strange new worlds, etc. But the Deep Space Nine music really matches the fact that the space station is really out there on its own. I mean, Deep Space Nine, to me, has never been my favourite music towards like the main score of the show, like the main theme, but it sort of matches where it is. And then you've got Voyager, which is sort of lost and trying to find its way back, which the music sort of shows. Enterprise is, without wanting to sing it, Brandy.
I already did that once this week.
I know, but there's never a time where we shouldn't be singing it.
That's true.
And then this show, like, I learned to play this on the piano because it's just such a fun, cool, poppy little, it's just joyful, but, you know what I mean. I don't know what I'm trying to say here.
No, I understand what you mean. Here's my thing. Here's my thing with the Deep Space Nine theme. I don't know what time signature it's trying to be in. It keeps changing time signatures, and I can't even figure it out until they get to the middle part, where it's da 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 da, you know. And then suddenly it's like, okay, now we're in 4/4 time. I get that, but what is the rest of this? I don't understand it, and it makes no sense in my brain, and it frustrates me because I'm really good at recognizing time signatures. And I cannot figure that one out. I would like to see the sheet music so that I could look at it and maybe understand.
So glad to hear someone else say that, because I love the Deep Space Nine theme.
Yeah.
But I kind of feel that way about it as well.
I've been trying for 25 years, and I still don't get it.
I've never noticed.
Well, darling, I don't think you have a ton of musical training, so that could be part of it.
Nah, it's possible. But I will say that there is something a bit funky with the dun 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 bit of the Discovery theme.
It's not like really something really bizarre, because your common ones are 4/4
time. It's hard to play because it's not on the beats. I found it hard to play.
That's fair. So
the other thing that we've obviously all been finding out recently is that Jeff Russo hasn't been able to get the orchestra together very well for recording due to COVID-19, obviously, because and he says on this little feature that he has to see the things on the screen before he can score it, like the interplay between the characters and how the emotions read from the scene before you can actually score it. So that's obviously one of the reasons Discovery is, season 3 has been delayed.
Yeah, but he started remote recording now.
So. Yeah, well, yeah.
And how do you do that? How do you remote record an entire orchestra?
You do it each musician individually. And
Oh my God.
Go find his little interview that he did about this. I think you can probably find it on one of the Trek websites or on Twitter. And it's still the amount of work that it takes to make sure everybody has the same recording equipment, everybody's at the same level, everybody's in a room where there's not going to be noise coming in and interfering, all of those things. It's not easy, and it's going to be a very much more painstaking process, but at least it's getting worked on instead of just nothing progressing.
Can you imagine a Zoom recording with just Jeff Russo and the guy with the triangle? No. You did that ding too early. Oh, ding!
Yeah, that's the thing. It's a challenge that boggles my mind.
Mm.
It really, truly does. But he's making it work so far. So, fingers crossed.
So, next one, I was excited about this one because I love prop making and costume making and all that sort of stuff. So the next one is Creature Comforts, where they're looking at Alchemy Studios, who did all their prosthetic stuff, and how they made the prosthetics work, you know, the Klingons, the Vulcans, the Kelpians, everything. And this was brilliant. There was obviously a lot of Doug Jones in this one talking about the process of putting on Saru. There's so much. And this technology has progressed so much just in the past few years. I forget what it is. Because all of this stuff basically used to just be rubber. And now it's like-
It used to be latex and now it's silicone.
Latex. Now it's silicone. That's the one. Yeah. It's amazing, all of the work that goes into this sort of stuff. Like, I have toured the Weta Workshop place in Wellington in New Zealand, you know, where they have all of the props and costumes and stuff for the Lord of the Rings films.
Oh, yeah.
So it would be really, really cool to sort of go behind the scenes and actually look at some of the stuff from Star Trek Discovery close up.
And the amount of time it takes, even though they've created these shortcuts, like having the sort of head stocking sort of thing, that's already got the bits on it, and then they apply the rest of the face and such. But there's still so much detail work that goes into that. And I know that. I already knew that. But seeing it actually take place, again, is just mind-boggling.
I mean, Alex Kurtzman hits the nail on the head, though, when he goes that the more tactile and real the makeup looks, the more immersive and real it will be for the audience.
Agree.
Of course.
And for the actors.
Well, yeah, because if you can't act through those latex, I mean, props to anyone who acts through that amount of makeup. Doug Jones does a wonderful job, but he's wearing silicone, which means his facial expressions are slightly easier to move than, I guess, someone who's wearing full-on Cardassian makeup like Andrew Robinson for Garrett, which I was watching Deep Space Nine. Well, I'm trying to watch Deep Space Nine with Jordan at the moment, but he seems to be every time he's looking on his phone because he doesn't like Kai Winn, and I don't like understand why anyone wouldn't like Kai Winn, but that's a totally different story.
Well, I don't like Kai Winn, but I love Louise Fletcher.
I love the character. I love.
I don't. Nah. You're not supposed to like her.
Yeah, but
you're
I like the mean ones. Awful. I like the awful people.
I don't, because I have enough mean people in my real life.
She is, how you'd say in the wrestling fandom, an effective heel.
Oh, she's like the uber heel. Just, I mean, even Gul Dukat does not come close to Kai Winn, you guys.
But, what was I saying? Yeah, but like, acting through the makeup is, And the fact that they were obviously, we all know what Saru was going to look like with all the eyes, and we've written into the USS Wadley Pari storylines that we're doing is Broj the Projan.
That's right. I've forgotten the name we gave him.
Yeah. Oh, I have it all in my notebook right here.
And the character was going to be 100% CGI, like Doug Jones' body with a CGI head. And cost aside, they wanted Doug's acting through the mask because they knew how well he could act.
Exactly. And just behind the scenes makeup stuff is always so fascinating and so amazing. And there's just so much effort and commitment from everyone involved, because you've got all these makeup artists and the people who design it and make it, and they manage to make just bits of silicone and stuff look like a real living creature. And then the actor who has to sit there for, you know, even now with all the new technology, they're still sitting there for several hours having all this stuff put on their face. And then to act through it, quite often not being able to see or breathe properly.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Yeah. But Doug Jones is the master of acting with a bunch of stuff on his face and body. And if you want to know more about some of his experiences, I recommend going to Anson Mount's podcast, The Well, and going back to listen to the two Doug Jones episodes that he did while he was working on season two of Discovery. I adore Doug Jones, and I've always adored him and respected him. And that reached a new level when I was able to actually just hear him talk with a friend about his time in creature work and some really funny stories.
Oh, it was brilliant.
Great. I actually remember him from the 80s when he was, what was the name of the thing? He was on this series of McDonald's commercials where
he was the big moon head.
Yeah, that's the first time I remember seeing Doug Jones. I mean, I didn't know it was Doug Jones then, but I did shortly thereafter. And then I'm like, got to keep an eye on that guy.
It's a little bit like, actually, no, because I said Hellboy was the first thing I saw him in. It wasn't, but it was the first thing I realized.
Yes.
Because isn't he the reanimated dead guy in Hocus Pocus?
I believe so, yes. I've never seen Hocus Pocus, so I couldn't say.
So there's a kind of like a remix musician named Neil Cicierega, who, if you go back and look at the stuff that he's done, he did basically every, like, almost everything that went, like, viral in the early days of the internet, like Ultimate Showdown. He did music under the name Lemon Demon, Harry Potter Puppet Pals. It was all the same guy, and you don't realize it. Like, that's Doug Jones is like that, but with, like, creature makeup work.
Mm-hmm. He has been in so many things. So many things. Somebody, if you want to, just go on IMDb and look up Doug Jones, and you will lose your mind at how much stuff he's done.
Well, I'm still stuck on you saying he was in Macca's commercial or something.
McDonald's.
Oh, yeah. Way, way, like, 80s. It was called
Mac Tonight? I think it was Mac at Night. I can't remember off the top of
something
my head.
Like that.
But I remember those commercials very vividly because they terrified some people. There it is. That's Doug.
that's Doug Jones.
That's Doug
that
Jones.
Weird, terrifying moon face guy. Mm-hmm.
No way.
Totally is.
I think he said in an interview, this was one of his first acting gigs. Oh, I don't know what you're going to do with that, Liam, with that music on it.
He's just dumbfounded.
That was Doug Jones?
Yes.
I'm wondering if we can have that as our artwork.
You could try.
We could call the episode, That Was Doug Jones.
Well, I'm dumbfounded at that.
Yeah.
Well, let's see.
So, moving on, I think, maybe. I don't know.
Yeah, that's a good note to leave that on. This. Yeah, so much great stuff went into that. Briefly about that, it was great hearing about. I think that was where they talked a little bit about the redesign of the Klingons, which we talked at length about in our last episode. But yeah, this was sort of the first time they were talking about all the extra sensory stuff in these like pits and holes on all the ridges down the backs of the heads, and that was just brilliant to see all the design going into that as well. And speaking of design, so the next one is called Designing Discovery. Yes. So this one is much more about the production design, set design, and actually designing the ships themselves as well.
Yes, I enjoyed this very much because ships. And I got to once again see, you know, those Klingon ships in action. And I just thought, oh, they're so beautiful. Why don't I have a sarcophagus ship?
I like how they were talking about the marine and submarine architecture and like the large naval vessel that they were towards the Discovery.
Yeah.
Because that's how they designed the Enterprise NX-01. Because they haven't quite got from Marine and Navy to the hotel in space kind of thing, like the 1701D.
Well, you got to have families now so that people's, you know, lives can continue while they're doing their job.
But it took them 10 months to make the Shenzhou Bridge.
That's crazy.
Wow.
When seeing some of that process sped up, it really puts into perspective how much work goes into that. There's so much work. And not just that, but the interiors and the lighting being built into the set itself.
Yeah.
How smart is
that?
It's
like they're proper real spaces. Like it, I feel like this must have done wonders for the people acting in them. And I know there was an interview with one of the actors, may have been Jason Isaacs, I can't remember exactly who, but talking about acting in that space. You know, you can walk in and it's like you are really there. Mm-hmm. It's like there's, you know, green screens out through the viewer and there's cameras and stuff, but it's like they put in so much detail to all the consoles and just the bulkheads and the walls and everything that it's like it would feel like a real place. Even the, you know, all the screens and transparencies and stuff were there. They weren't added in post.
Going back to what you said about those see-through screens being actually there and tactile and able to be used, Tamara Devereaux, the production designer, was saying that they were the only ones available in the world. Like, that's amazing. And I wish we still had those. Like, I think you said, Brandy, that they don't make them anymore.
I believe that's what I heard. I could be mistaken. It wouldn't be the first time I've been mistaken about something. But it seemed to me like it was a very limited amount of them, and they weren't producing them anymore. So they gathered all that they could. They grabbed all that they could, bought all they could. So that's what I remember hearing. I could be wrong. How much better does it make it realistically? Because the realism of it is, you can't put a value on that. It's just, it's invaluable. It's invaluable for the actors, especially.
Well, it immerses them and they don't have to imagine things.
Yes. It's always better when you don't have to imagine things and you actually have something right in front of you that you're using and touching.
Bit that I most liked about the Design and Discovery feature was the bit when they were talking about the Orion Embassy on Kronos.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, that was really fun.
How the majority of that storyline was made around how they wanted to create the set. Because they're like, oh, we're going to Kronos. Oh, let's go to an Orion Embassy on Kronos. Let's make it like a market and like a cabaret. And then they wrote that into the show as opposed to the production running around the writing of the show, which I thought was awesome. And then we also saw an Orion butt in the actual episode. That was nice.
That particular sequence for me was, how many Star Trek references can you cram into one scene? Let's find
out. They had the little, what are they called? The SETI eels? The SETI alpha eel things frying in a pan. Mm-hmm. That was fun.
It's like, ew, gross. Why would you eat that? No, thank you.
Yeah, I thought that was cool. And then the Charon the mycelial sun that powers the ship.
Oh. Yeah.
That wasn't ever designed as part of the storyline. That was written in because Tamara Devereaux was like, let's have something huge in this ship.
Mm.
And it looks fantastic.
Yeah. Yeah, it's like the relationship between production design, set design, and I guess costuming is not just taken from the writing department, but they'll work with each other to create something truly spectacular.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And especially everything that goes into the detailing and kind of the thought that goes into why those particular details were chosen. Like, everyone kind of knows what the look of Starfleet is. You know, it's very clean, and in this case, they were all of, like, bare metallics and stuff like that and quite shiny.
Mm.
Obviously, the Klingons in this, it was very ornate and gothic. I think in this feature, they mentioned that they were inspired by a lot of Islamic architecture as well, which is very, very ornate, especially if you see the sort of stuff that's at the Hagia Sophia.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure I heard someone at some point mentioning that was an inspiration for, like, the interior of the sarcophagus ship. And also just the fact that they wanted to use the set designs in that to put across that they're a very ancient culture and that the sarcophagus ship really is like a church to them.
Mm.
And then all of, like, they mentioned, like, kind of Soviet brutalist architecture as an inspiration for all the Mirror Universe interiors and stuff, like on board the Charon.
Mm-hmm.
That was really cool.
Production design is another one of those things that boggles my mind. Where do you get that inspiration? How do you suddenly decide, oh, I'm going to look at this? I guess it's because my brain is just so chaotic that I can't imagine being able to focus on one thing long enough to get inspiration and incorporate not only one inspiration, but several into one cohesive, magnificent set design. I bow to the production designers. It just blows my mind.
They also mentioned Byzantine and medieval architecture as well.
Yeah.
So, and the next one on the list, another great sort of production design one, creating space. So, this one, it was looking at the visual effect company Pixondo and how they did, I guess, all the sort of CGI backgrounds and all that kind of visual effects stuff. And just so they showed a lot of shots in this one of, like, the first big space scene that we get, obviously, is the binary stars, which just looks spectacular.
Mm-hmm.
And I love that stuff. I'm like a little personal story. My grandmother, who passed away nearly a year ago at 99, was an artist for about the last sort of 35 years of her life. And the works that she painted were like abstract, really like swirling colors and looked like that. She always told me that her inspiration was like nebulae and images of space, or like how she thought the beginning of the universe looked. So I've always just had an eye for like beautiful spacescapes. Mm. This was just really cool, and it reminded me of her paintings, which was nice.
Aww. That's very tender. That warms my heart.
I don't know where to go with that.
It's just, space is pretty.
It is. And they made it look extra pretty.
Yes, they did.
Actually, there was another really cool, they had a really good side-by-side shot. I think it was in this feature of the scene at the beginning where Burnham and Georgiou are on the desert planet.
Yes.
Yeah. And it's showing the finished shot with all of the effect, and then the sort of the raw camera footage with just a couple of the little CG mock-ups and mm-hmm. stuff.
The previs work.
And it's just amazing how much goes into it that you don't notice.
None of it was real. It's like
yeah. It's just that's like, you know, they pan up and you're just like, okay, all these clouds and stuff with the Shenzhou flowing through. You're just like, okay, so obviously that's been done digitally, but it looks really good and you can't really tell. Aside, like, it would look like a real life sandstorm if it weren't for the fact that there's a spaceship flying through it.
Yeah.
But then you don't realize that it's all CG and some of the mountains behind it and just...
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then when the realistic view is when you look up and it's just blue sky.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
That was insane.
Crazy.
At the end of this feature, there was that sequence of just all the amazing different CGI stuff that they put in, where it was the mycelial network, the space battles, space itself, the ships, the spore drumps, what else, like explosions. It just shows or reminded me of how spoilt we are with television now.
Mm.
Like the yeah. line between the movies and TV is now so blurred that I don't think one can accept a TV show that's poor quality in the sci-fi and fantasy realm now.
Yeah. No, I totally get that. Well, and I think that's actually a good thing for-
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Especially for actors, because it used to be that actors had this sort of bias against working on television. It's like, oh, no, I don't do television. Mm. But now television is the big thing. Everybody does television. Stars that you never would have seen on television before are now in television series. Mm. And I love that. They're finally making the most of this medium.
And it's these short form streaming shows that have like movie level budgets.
Yeah.
I feel like Game of Thrones probably kicked it off. I'm just so excited that we are getting Star Trek in this format, just in general, because it's my favorite way to watch media, I guess. Mm-hmm. Because, like, I was always the person with, like, movie adaptations of books. Like, there are some that I really like. Like, I love the Lord of the Rings movies. But often, just to get it to the point of being, like, even, like, a three-hour movie, so much has to be lost from the original source material. So, like, making those sorts of adaptations for TV shows are great. And, yeah, it's awesome that they have the budget to do it justice now.
Agree.
Well, that's the thing with movies, you have to cut out so many things, like you said, that could actually be vital to the movie. I mean, there's some movies you think, well, how the hell did that happen? And it turns out they made a dodgy cut.
Anyway, the next feature in the list was called Prop Me Up.
I love this one. I love this one.
This one was really good.
Yeah.
This is all about the prop design.
Yes.
So nice.
And people think that prop design and costume design are like two different worlds, and they work together so much. Mm. They like feed off of each other and give each other ideas and work in tandem. I love this. I mean, I love all of these special features, but this one really just, very enjoyable for me.
I like how they called it a period show.
Well, yeah, actually it kind of was. I love that when they're, so they went back to all of the props from the original series and like, okay, how do we make something that looks like it will turn into this in, you know, 10 years time, but at the same time, like still feels like real and feels like, you know, believable to an audience in like the late 2010s.
Well, that's the problem, isn't it? Because we have so many things that are more advanced now. Like, this iPhone is more advanced and thinner than the pads, etc., that they had in TNG. My laptop right now is nowhere near the size of those chunky boys that we found, you know?
Yeah.
The chunky boys.
Chunky.
and that is the problem. It's a balancing act of having something 200 years in the future and also not being behind the technology that we have now based on the fact that the original stuff was made in the 1960s.
And it's like, obviously, some things need to just be, like, set aside and say, well, look, yeah, our modern technology is more advanced than that thing was. We have to make it look different. But they, even with that, they still did so much, you know, I guess, right, in inverted commas. Like, they did so much that still fit in. Like, I think watching this little behind-the-scenes thing more than any other shows just how much they really do care for and respect what came before, and they want to make something that looks just like a proper modernization. And it's, you know,
they are absolutely honoring what came before,
100%. But they've also updated things a little bit in terms of obviously being modern, and that they made batlets and mekleths slightly different for each house. Each house.
That was really cool.
That was so cool.
And why were they talking about how the reason why they designed their new batleth a bit differently, with like the blades curving the opposite way, was because they were seeing it as slightly more of a defensive weapon because of the stage that the Klingons are at in their culture at that point, because they're a bit more sort of insular and defensive because they are expecting attack from other houses at any point or something like that. It's just...
But you flip it over and now it's offensive. Oh, that was amazing.
It's like you can tell that this is a show made by nerds, because that's the sort of person who thinks to that level of detail about just a single little prop.
I love that.
And the little thing about the Klingon Empire... wrong words. And the bit about the Terran Empire, that's the empire that I wanted to talk about. The badges have scout, like little scout marks on them.
Yeah.
Scout marks.
You know, like, oh, you've got 50 kills or Master of Poisons or, I don't know, tie your shoelaces in the dark or something.
And, like. and the globes were different colors depending on what their rank was, and also, you know, how many kills they had.
Yeah.
Why don't they put those badges out?
That would be awesome. I would love a Terran Empire.
Yeah.
Because there's a Terran Empire badge out, but it's not the Discovery one. And there were like at least 4 different versions of that badge. Why aren't those out? Because all the other Discovery badges are out.
Mm.
Let's have the Terran Empire badges. I want to complete my collection, please.
I've got a question for both of you. And this is a tangent. We see all these different kind of like marks on the Terran Empire badges. Brandy, what would your mark be? What are you master of in the Terran Empire?
I'd have to think about that. Because I'm trying to think of what would be completely opposite of the person I am now. It would have something to do with being completely ruthless and dispassionate. So, because...
What about you, Nick?
Would there be some kind of, like, master of, like, giant engineered attack beetles or something?
Oh, my God. I love that aspect of it. I love that. I want to see giant engineered attack beetles. I want that now. Mm.
Strange New Worlds. There we go. We'll put it in there.
I want that now. I want it. I think I would probably be a master of maiming.
Master of maiming.
Yeah.
That sounds like one that would exist.
Because I don't want the person to die, because once they die, the fun is over for me. I want the pain to continue as long as
possible.
Because
you wouldn't have the emotion, would you?
No, I wouldn't. I would get my... The only time I would ever feel anything is when I'm torturing someone else.
And that'll be joy.
You'd be the one who sees... What are their things? You'd see, you know, You'd be someone who's like, oh, no, I don't use the agonizer booth. I'm not going to automate my job out of existence.
No. I am up close and personal with that stuff. And I know just how much to take off a body before it becomes fatal.
Whoa.
Well, Randy Jackler, you wanted to know.
Master of maiming.
That would be my Dr. mirror
collision. Master of giant attack beetles.
Yes.
I don't even know what I would be.
Oh, come on.
I'd probably be nice. Master of niceties.
I'm just imagining Mira Liam would just be like super, super innocent.
Master of naivety.
Yeah. That's his weapon.
Naive.
They're like, oh, he couldn't possibly be that gullible. Oh, wait, he is? Oh, he is? Okay. I'm so confused. He would just confuse everyone into disarray.
So the next one on the list is A Woman's Journey, which was a really interesting one, looking at the perspective of the different, you know, leading female characters in the show. And it actually did a really good job of showing how they have so many different portrayals of a strong woman character, which is just, yeah, like really interesting.
That's because not all women are the same. Mm-hmm. And I love
shock horror.
Yeah, I love seeing also the women behind the scenes talking.
Yeah, that was so good.
This one really spoke to me on a very personal level because some of you may know I identify as a woman. So it's just hearing their enthusiasm of being in a room full of women and talking about this show and what they're going to do. It was just, we need more of that, please.
Well, it's like Kirsten Beyer. That's what you're talking about, isn't it? There, that Kirsten Beyer said that I think this might be the first time in the history of Star Trek where it's just been four women in a room deciding the direction of a Star Trek Discovery show.
Yeah.
And the direction of the franchise.
Magnificent. It made me so happy. It made me feel validated. You know, women can do these things. They've always been able to do these things. It's just that they haven't been allowed to do these things.
Well, it just goes to show that you can have a room full of three women or four women to do a show, whether it's a Star Trek show or a Star Trek podcast or, you know, like it just says that everyone can do anything. And I mean, I can't think of another show that makes or that has this many strong female characters in control of things with like Laurel and Georgiou and Burnham. Equal to the men and, you know, often surpassing the male characters, in my opinion. And they're also nuanced, as Mary Chufo says. And, yeah, it's just amazing.
I love it. And that's yet another reason that Discovery appeals to me on so many levels. Because, again, women everywhere are feeling represented.
Yeah. It did a good job of not just having, you know, all these good characters on camera, but actually having a lot of women and a lot of diversity of, you know, people of different, like, races and ethnicities and everything like that behind the camera and working on it as well.
Yeah.
Even for me as a, you know, a straight white guy, I want to see shows, especially Star Trek, made by people with many different perspectives and many different backgrounds in life.
Agree.
Because that's what this show should be.
Agree. Infinite diversity and infinite combinations.
Yes, exactly.
Except the Vulcans aren't very good at practicing that, are they? Sorry. No more tangents from Brandy.
So, and then we move on to the second last of the little extra features. I think this one was my favorite. So, this is Dress for Success, and this is talking about the costume design. Mm-hmm. And just like the like creature makeup design and the prop design stuff, I love finding out about everything that's involved in the making of, you know, the things that make the world look good behind the scenes.
Yes.
And this was overall just a really good, well-made little behind-the-scenes feature. Like, they had a lot of good interviews with people and they just took you through the entire process of making the Klingon armor costume.
My God. It's amazing.
Oh, wow. I mean, it's amazing what you can do with a bit of spray paint, a squirt bottle of alcohol and an iron and a hairdryer.
Yes.
Yeah.
And it looks so good that what they're so good at what they do.
And so many people do it. And it's in just one great big warehouse and just like the little the ingenuity of some of the little pieces, like the little stones, and then they've just like colored them in with a bit of paint and like gemstones and
little bits of iron pyrite and stuff.
That's just amazing.
Don't say pyrite and pyrrhotite. I'm so over iron and pyrite and pyrrhotite and pedlandite and chalcopyrite.
Sorry. I hadn't.
That's what my report's about.
Are these the samples that you forgot to sonicate?
Oh, I've got, all cobalt pentlandites. I've got to sonicate them. Anyway, carry on.
I'm sorry, I didn't know that you would be triggered by pyrite.
Triggered by pyrite.
Oh, wow.
Oh, breathe.
Oh, dear. Yeah, I especially loved that Klingon armor was what they decided to show you the process of. And, like, obviously they did because it's one of the most intricate costumes they had. But just I loved that and everything that went into it, especially, like, Laurel's version of it, like the white one with those – where you can really see, like, those bright red, like, gemstone spikes on it. And, of course, they had some of the wonderful stuff talking about how they designed the Mirror Universe costumes in this as well. With, like, the laser-cut leather for that cool, very, like brutalist or, like, Art Deco angular designs on the chest plates and stuff.
Yes. Yes. And they look so metallic.
And even just about the designing of, like, the regular Starfleet uniforms, you know, talking about the, the different panels and everything, trying to make it look like, you know, it sort of harkened back to the original uniforms a little bit, but was also sort of very functional. And you have Jason Isaacs saying that they were so tight, but yet stretchy, so it was just like body paint.
Oh, yeah. And how the stuff didn't wrinkle.
Oh, yeah. It just, like, would not wrinkle.
See, what do you guys think of the uniforms in terms of they obviously follow on from the Enterprise uniforms because they're blue. Yeah. And then they follow on from the fact that there's different piping and colours for the different, you know, the divisions, etc. But what did you think of the gold, silver and bronze? Because I will admit, I have a lot of trouble distinguishing between the gold and the bronze.
I was going to say the same thing. Yeah. I think it's really...
Like, it's beautiful.
It was an interesting direction for them to take it. And, yeah, and they looked spectacular. But... if you were to look at it from a point of view of, like, would this actually be practical if it were a real thing? Yeah, I think their bronze could have looked a little bit more actual, like, red coppery in order to make the differentiation a bit more clear.
Yeah, because I this is probably the only series that I haven't been able to easily tell. And obviously, the difference between red, yellow and blue is, you know, massive. So, of course, in every series, you can tell. You also, because of the badges that have the pips on them, you can't see which rank people are either. So, I mean, it's probably not the end of the world. But at the same time, it's sort of one of those things that have been around in all of Trek, but you can probably forgive. I would personally have preferred a slightly different bronze colour, as you say, Nick, and somewhere different for the rank part of it. Maybe even, like, you know how they've got, like, the bits that go over their shoulder? Maybe if they were the bits that would have had, like, the one for...
They talked about that, though, and it didn't work.
Yeah, they wanted to have... Yeah, I think they said they tried a few things, but they wanted to have very clean lines for the uniforms itself.
Yeah.
It's interesting, though, that I wonder what the in-universe explanation could be from going from... Enterprise to the gold, silver, and bronze, and then back to, you know, what Pike is wearing. Because all they got is, oh, you got the new uniforms.
I wonder if it would be, because just before, it's very much implied that before the Klingon War starts, it's really like a golden age of exploration. So maybe these are, like, you know, the practically putting on, you know, a dress uniform for everyday wear because, you know, Starfleet has to look their best, you know, present themselves as their best when they're meeting new life and new civilizations. And then, I don't know, maybe they did have the issue that we brought up. And I'm like, hang on, we can't really just at a glance tell the difference between a commander and an engineering officer. So, maybe we should just go back to the standard primary colors.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, why does anything like that change? Why in the 50s were men wearing their pants that came up practically to their nipples, and then suddenly in the 60s it's completely different, like hip huggers and stuff? So, why does anybody change anything? I don't know.
Are we not meant to be wearing our pants up by our nipples now?
No.
Oh, I should take my nipple pants off. Sorry, carry on. I've totally sidetracked your thing.
There's one great bit in the Dress for Success feature. So when they were talking about the Mirror Universe costumes, and actually there was two great bits about this related to Michelle Yeoh's costume as Emperor Giorgio. Just that beautiful, like, gold, like, robe and everything. One thing was apparently there was not necessarily miscommunication, but just like it was. Possibly Kirsten Bio or someone saw like the design for like the kind of plinth that she stands on, and also like her kind of spreading out cape, and was just like, "Ooh, have to get some proper measurements to make sure that's going to fit, or something is going to have to be changed last minute." And she was like running between the like costume or the different departments to like measure Michelle Yeoh in her costume and then like run back with that to the props department. It's like, oh no, she's going to fit. Cool.
Yeah.
And there was another story that Michelle Yeoh was telling about just how terrifying she got to look in that thing. And she was talking about when Sonequa Martin-Green brought her young son to the set. And she said that, you know, they all know each other and you know, she would play with the kid quite often. Sonequa brings young, I think her son's name is Kendrick.
It's Kendrick Jr., so K2. They Junior. Called him K2 yeah. a lot.
K2, that's right. They call him K2. Yeah. So, she brings him in on the set, and then Michelle Yeoh is there in her full, like, regalia as the Emperor, looks over and just like, hi, Kendrick! And the kid is just like, nope, and just, like, hides behind Sonequa.
Like, that's Michelle! It's Michelle!
So she's like, nope.
Yeah.
Oh, dear. Yeah. So, that was, Dress for Success. It was so much great costume design. And the last feature is, it's just called Star Trek Discovery, The Voyage of Season 1. And this is really just the cast and crew going through it episode by episode and kind of telling the story of it, which is actually kind of nice to watch because it's been a little while since I've watched the whole series all the way through. They didn't go into as much detail with this one as they have with all of the others. This was just a little bit more about, I guess, about their feelings on each episode and like what the characters are doing and talking about the the growth of the characters through the show, really. Like each actor was talking about like how their character kind of grows and matures as they're going through, which is a very interesting thing to see, especially with characters like Michael Burnham and Ash and Laurel, with all of the changes that they go through.
Yeah, I liked this feature a lot. It's, what's the word I'm looking for here? Comprehensive. And it's kind of like summing up everything that we've seen so far in the special features, but with the actors and their viewpoints of the progression of their characters. And plus, you know, a lot of behind the scenes people are on it as well. But I really love the fact that they actually talk to the main cast, because we didn't get a ton of that. We got some Doug Jones, and we got a bit of Mary Wiseman, and we got Sonequa, but we didn't really get everybody. We didn't get Wilson. We didn't get Anthony, you know, and we get all of that in this final feature. Yeah. And we find out that Rainn Wilson is a huge fan of Harry Mudd. So he wanted to play that character.
Yeah, actually, I did see that. That was pretty funny because, I mean, for someone to probably petition to be on the show, I'm guessing.
Yeah, I'm sure he wanted to be on the show. I'm absolutely sure of that. the thing is, you know, I'm not a fan of Harry Mudd. I appreciate his performance as Harry Mudd. I truly do. He brought a different facet to it that I was not expecting and that I appreciated, even though I am never going to like Harry Mudd. And I don't think I'm supposed to like him. I think he's a horrible human being, but he does make some salient points about, you know, what it's like for the people who aren't on the starships. So,
yeah. I like whenever we get that look into outside of Starfleet and the Federation. You know, it's like Raffi talks about it in Star Trek Picard, and then there's one of the many wonderful Sisko speeches in DS9 where he, you know, talks about it's easy to be a saint in paradise. Mm-hmm. That's, yeah, so it's that. It's just a little, like, crack in the armor of, like, the sort of perfect society of Starfleet and the Federation. Yes. So, do we want to do a final thoughts or anything like that?
I just really appreciate all the work that goes into the show, and I guess watching some of these features made me realize just how much is in there.
Yeah, I mean, I was just going to add on to that. It's like you don't really realize how much goes into these. And like I've said, that I love watching behind-the-scenes stuff for anything, and like going and visiting like recreations of sets or anything like that, that whenever you get the chance. Like I've seen the Hobbit sets in New Zealand and like the Harry Potter sets in the UK, and it's always just so much fun to go and see how much detail goes in, and things that would never actually show up on camera, but it just shows the dedication of the people making it, who want to craft a realistic, livable world. Because when you do that, the people who are acting in it are going to feel more immersed in what they're portraying, and it will just make for a much better production in the end.
Same. I think watching these special features, which again took about 3 hours for me, I was thinking about how much they put into these special features and thinking about how that was such a small sliver of what actually took place. Like probably what we saw in these special features was actually like a 1/1000th of a percent of the work that actually went into all of this. And I've always had respect for the show and the people behind the scenes, but that respect has achieved a new level by getting a taste of what actually went on and what troubles they had and how they overcame them, how they all of the departments working together and inspiring each other. It's very eye-opening, and it made me just love the show that much more.
We also have a review that we want to read out that we received on the iTunes store.
Want is not the proper word for that, but anyway.
Fire away, Brandy. How are you going to read
all
this?
All right. This is a 1-star review from Blizzard Wind that says, "This show used to be the best. The Edge was my favorite Star Trek Discovery podcast when it came out. Unfortunately, with multiple host changes, it has devolved into a show that is all about the hosts, their emotional traumas, their homosexual fantasies about the cast of the show, and a guy who says nothing but yeah about everything the other two say. It's no longer about Star Trek Discovery. I know that hosting podcasts is a labor of love and volunteer, but please stick to the subject matter." Of course it's about the hosts. Do you listen to shows just for the content? I'm sorry. Okay, I'm not sorry. I'm not sorry. I'm not actually going to apologize for that, because I asked several people, when you listen to a podcast, what is the first thing you look for? And they're like, well, I'm looking for a podcast about this, but whether or not they like the hosts will determine if they continue listening to said podcast.
Yeah, exactly.
So the content is actually secondary. Once they've found that thing that they think that they'll fit well with, if they don't like the host, they're out of there. So if people don't like us, you know, I'm sorry about that. We're real people. This is not a scripted show. We are expressing our love for this show. And yes, like real people, we sometimes wander off down tangent lane. And that's something that's just always going to happen in a group conversation. Actually, it happens even when I'm doing a solo podcast by myself.
It does.
And it happens in many, many podcasts. I mean, I would say one of the kind of bigger, well-known podcasts, at least that I listen to, is Stuff You Should Know, which is a brilliant podcast. It's all sorts of just random facts about stuff. And those two go on massive tangents.
Of course. We are always...
It's just what happens.
We're always talking about Star Trek Discovery. And part of that is talking about how it affects our lives. And that is a normal part of talking about anything that you love. Is it not?
And as far... I'm assuming I'm the one that's bringing up the homosexual fantasies about the crew. Well...
I don't know. I'd do Mary Wiseman. You're probably going to have to cut that out.
But look, I mean, you don't hear half of the stuff that I say. So if that bothers you, well, you know what? Ask for some of our outtakes, because quite frankly.
Yeah. And also, if you want to be constructive, that's one thing. But using absolutes by saying a guy who says nothing but yeah, that is absolutely not true.
No. Nick sometimes says no.
I could disagree with you guys more if you like. Oh, damn it.
Oh. You guys, this is why I love podcasting with the two of you, because I always have so much fun and it brings so much joy to me.
Yeah.
And I would not have this any other way. So.
And you know what? At least we're not boring.
We're not bad.
Because there's plenty of boring podcasts out there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I don't want this podcast to be a newscast. You know, I don't want this to be a step-by-step dissection of everything that happens in Star Trek Discovery. There's no fun in that.
No.
Plenty of people can do that and have done that.
So, the long and the short of it is that Star Trek affects us in ways that affect us individually. So, it may bring up some emotional trauma. Star Trek has some attractive actors in it. And if I want to talk about Ethan Peck's pecs, I will talk about Ethan Peck's pecs. And if Nick wants to say yeah to everything, he's more than entitled to say yeah. But he does have more of an opinion than just yeah, as you can probably hear throughout every single show. But I will say thank you for saying that it is a labor of love, because it is a labor of love.
And we do love doing it.
Yes. Hey guys, it's Liam here. Just wanted to jump in whilst doing the editing after we've spoken about the review from Blizzard Wind to state that a few days ago, after we recorded this episode, that they had actually deleted it. So their comment now goes, update. I was a bit harsh with my previous comment. It was meant to critique rather than offend. It was obvious during the recent episode that the comment was in front of you to the point of parody. There were multiple side references to it. Most recent episode, much more subject matter focused. Now, the episode that they're referring to is the Klingon episode that came out last Friday, or last Friday fortnight. We hadn't actually seen that review until recording of this particular podcast, because we record 2 weeks behind schedule. So, if you felt that there were multiple points in the episode that we were parodying your review, no, but there are multiple points in this episode that we were. Thank you for deleting the review, because it was harsh. However, you did offend some of us.
Anyway... Well, it has been fun talking about all the behind-the-scenes features of Star Trek Discovery Season 1. But, of course, this isn't the only thing we've been discussing on the network. So, here's a quick look at some of the other things you may have missed elsewhere on Trek FM.
Previously on Trek.fm, Earl Grey.
I guess what I'm seeing is that we're taking some of these later Borg ideas and kind of retconning them back into the best of both worlds. It's stuff that's not necessarily
that
there.
That is exactly what's happening, because I remember Picard saying, like in First Contact, I can hear their voices.
Hear them.
You know,
right,
but that's way further than where we are. So, oh my goodness, what our mind does. Crazy.
Literary Treks.
And suddenly now there aren't dozens of movies in the Kelvin universe. So it's not such a critical matter for original novels to be set in that universe to come out. When I was writing The Unsettling Stars, which was not the original title, but that's what we're going to call it because that's what it is, I was very much aware of the two films that JJ had done, and I purposely wrote a book to do something that would not, in any way that I could think of, conflict with anything in the first two films.
Primitive Culture, a look at history and culture through Star Trek.
The corona epidemic is shocking. I mean, it's the, you know, we're having some of the most extreme measures being taken in, you know, living memory. I mean, you know, since the Second World War in this country, in many respects, the kind of things people are being asked to do, the level of involvement of the government in people's ordinary lives, totally unprecedented, certainly in, you know, our lifetimes, and frankly in the lifetimes of most people who are alive, you know, in this world at the moment. So there is that kind of sense that just when you think you're done with history, something happens and sort of reminds you that, that everything's not maybe as stable as it seems.
The Edge, a Star Trek Discovery podcast.
I don't want them to look like original series Klingons or like Next Generation Klingons or even like Enterprise Klingons. I don't want that. I want them to look just modern. Yeah, you don't need to try to match an aesthetic from 20 to 50 years ago. You really just don't. Don't do that.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
Check out all of these shows and join the conversation about your favorite corner of the Star Trek universe and beyond. You'll find us wherever you get your podcasts. If you're an Apple user, be sure to hit the subscribe button in Apple Podcasts on iPhone, iPad, or Apple TV, or the desktop podcasts app to get the latest episodes as soon as they're published. And please leave us a star rating and written review. It helps us jump up the charts and find more listeners.
If, God forbid, you are not an Apple user, don't worry, we got your back. You can find our shows on Google Podcasts, Stitcher, TuneIn, Spreaker, SoundCloud, YouTube, in most third-party apps, and you can stream and download the MP3 file from our website or grab the RSS link.
We would love to hear your thoughts on today's show, and there are many ways for you to do that. The best place to join the larger conversation is, of course, the Babel Conference, our listeners group on Facebook. Just type B-A-B-E-L into the search field on Facebook, and it should come right up.
If you'd like to send us an email, you can use the form on our website at trek.fm/contact. Choose to send to a show and select The Edge. That will come right to us. You can also find the network on Twitter at trek.fm and on Facebook at facebook.com/trek.fm. So, Nick, when you're not wearing your trousers right up to your armpits, where can we find you on the internet?
You can find me, first of all, on Twitter, where I am at punkzoologist. On Instagram, I am at punkrockzoologist, and I also hang out in the Babel Conference now and then, especially commenting on any one of our new videos that drop. So, Brandy, when you are not dressing up in a moon costume to advertise fast food, where can people find you?
You can find me on Twitter, BrandyWine12. You can find me on a live show on YouTube, Kurt Ratz Productions, with Bruce and Dan, called The Unready Room, where each week we cover a different episode or movie from the Star Trek universe. Hopefully this coming Friday. I don't know what it's going to be yet, because the poll that we have had from last night, as of this recording, has not yet ended. So tune in to see what it is we're going to talk about. And I really enjoyed that a lot. You can find it at 9 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. Pacific, if you want to actually watch it live, or you can also watch the video after the fact and still see that live show. You can find me on the Dark Corner podcast with my husband, Dave, where we talk about stuff and things, and we give zero cares about what anyone else thinks. We really just do whatever we want, and it's just always nerdy. We have our specific nerddoms, and we cover those, and I enjoy it greatly. And I also have my own solo podcast called Headcanon, where I wander off down many a tangent lane and talk about my dearest fandoms and also some of my weird dreams. So have fun with that. You can find both of those at darkcornerpodcast.com. Someday there'll be a live show about Discovery again. And I do that with Bruce Gibson, and we'll see when that happens. So, Liam, when you are not busy admiring Ethan Peck's pecs, where can people find you?
Wait, what? What? I'm sorry, I'm just looking behind you.
Are you looking at Ethan Peck's pecs?
I am. They're
distracting.
Yeah, they are. So you can find me Ethan Peck's pecs when I am on the Babel conference and at Ethan Peck's pecs on Twitter and at Ethan's Peck's pecs on about our Voyager podcast.
To be fair, there was a picture from when they were in Germany that it was posted by Shahzad Latif on his Instagram account, and it was him and Anson Mount and Ethan Peck on the stage, and Shahzad had written in Ethan's pecs and pointing to his chest, because he was standing like with his hands behind his back, you know, kind of like you do when you're, like when Pike left the bridge on Discovery for the final time. That's sort of stance, he was doing that, and so, hey, Shahzad Latif appreciates them, so...
So, realistically, at LS74656 on Twitter and Onto the Journey, our Star Trek Voyager podcast with Suzanne Williamson.
We would love to give a shout out to all of our wonderful behind-the-scenes APs, who are Norman C. Lau, Tony Robinson, Thomas Paleo, Lisa Slack, Shoaib Mirza, Richard Rutledge, James Muldrow, Cornelia Reutner, Ryan Mallett, and Chris Tribuzio. Thank you for supporting The Edge and Trek FM via Patreon. Now, if you'd like to become an associate producer of The Edge or one of the other shows on Trek FM and take part in our patrons' roundtables, please visit patreon.com/trekfm. I'm going to spell it for you, patreon.com/trekfm.
Thank you all for listening, and join us next time to see what's happening on The Edge. Of Federation space.
Oh, we totally cannot call this nipple pants.
Nipple pants.
So many great titles that we cannot use.